Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about Timbrook Taylor and the goodies. Just today, I suppose, probably the 13th of April, 13th or 12th of April, I'm returning what the timelines are. Timbrook Taylor, I think was his 79, died of coronavirus in England. And as all deaths are tragedies, and particularly, I suppose, vulnerable people, I suppose, which gets us more concerned about the people in nursing homes and the people in poorer countries, and this is without our health systems and infrastructure and communication systems, and I just think, and sort of there's a deep sympathy to the people in particularly the United States for having the ability and the wealth and the connection to fix it, but having a sort of a almost Shakespearean drama unfold at the top, and it's like you only need so many thousand people to die to get the message that there's people are not really connected. Now, the Timbrook Taylor particular aspect, why that would touch Australians more and people differently, and I don't want to mention British actors which haven't died, or British pop stars, or celebrities. So there's sort of celebrities which are in a celebrity bubble. They live in an exalted life. They arrive in superstar style. But Tim was a star of, I suppose, definitely a children's program, which we have copies of and we show our children, called The Goodies. And The Goodies had certain classic episodes like Kitten Kong, and one of the Giants, where I think The Goodies and the Giants. And so essentially it took iconic stories of our 60s and 70s and parodied them. Parodied them. So there was certain the precursors to that were the Goon Show with Peter Sellers, Harry Secombe, and Spike Milligan. And there was, because they weren't comedic actors at a particular time, so they weren't sort of the subject of tabloid stuff. I think you always get over and over pictures about Jennifer Anderson and these sort of adult American fictions, and then the sort of the American stars aren't that much, but the sort of the British and Australian homegrown stars were not communicated directly with the kids, and there wasn't a sense that you sort of had a feeling that they were on your side coming up to things. You felt, I suppose, at least felt a bit more normalcy with them, and I suppose it's a tragedy for him, but you sort of also sort of know the other people. So most people know sort of details about the Goodies or went to the Goodies reunion concert. And there was, the Goodies used to famously go around on a tricycle. Not a tricycle, a three-person tandem. So they came with a tandem walking frame onto the set, the very old stuff like that. And there was the fundamental, I suppose, children's, but triumvirate, Trinity, Holy Trinity. There was Timbrook Taylor, Bill Oddie, and I've Graham, I forgot what his second name is, with the big handle chop sideburns. The one promoting injecting the science has had this perfect viewpoint. This is one would introduce science, one would introduce the sort of adult establishment response to it, and the Bilotti would be the child rebel. So you have that group analysis cookie cutter going into these different situations. And there were things like I particularly liked is when they had an area, they had free rein to expand it. So they had the Dam Busters story. You know, when they geese from the Golden Egg used to come in, and they played the dam busting story, and they showed the egg roll and bounce. And this is, there are certain stories that used to be very resonant in the 70s, written by people at World War II. That the 1970s was that age after World War II where you could write or glorify World War II, and we used to read about Douglas Bader and Barnes. I forgot what his name is. Not Jimmy Barnes, but the inventor of the bouncing bomb. In terms of physics, it was very interesting. In terms of basic teaching, it was very interesting. But it was one of those stories where it was equivocal about the actual nature, sort of the nature of it, in terms of so many British airmen died to get such a relatively small effect, because there weren't that much, there wasn't, Germany was not that reliant on dams. But there was this story where you could actually, you had this, the set out story, you had the skipping stone, and then the rolling bouncing bomb. And in a certain sense, it was sort of in the era that a single idea could go forward. So there was a lot of World War II stories, a lot of stories like that, sort of basic stories stitched together. So if those stories stitch together to form your childhood, you can't sort of reference those, but you could reference the goodies, which referenced a whole heap of things. And this was like the peak of heroism is obviously the moon landing, and the structure and the risks and the stories with that. So these are a certain thing. So I suppose if in the United States we'd be someone where we have sort of a universal thing is Buck. What's his name? Neil Armstrong, the second person. Unfortunately, with his brain damage stuff, the names disappear. I've got the name, I've got the person, the fact file, stuff like that, but I just don't have access to that particular word. There's Collins, Armstrong, and I don't want to do it. B. Oh, it's gone. Look, unfortunately, if you know it, you've got it. Unfortunately, I'm one of these frustrating people. And sort of, I should say, this sort of brain damage type of stuff, it means that you don't go in with an optimized plan. You don't go in with an optimized plan. You go in with a plan to optimize. If I can quickly say, it's that you know that. So, like, when you're going camping or you're going for a picnic, you need your rug, you need your plan ahead a bit. So I'm beginning, my plan is to plan to optimize when I get there. I just I just the name really goes, but his stories are really humanized stories, and there's a few scientists and occasionally we have sporting stars on this level. BB can't get it, unfortunately. You no, so that's in that particular level, and this sort of common background in predicting how you see it. So people in the United States and different countries wouldn't necessarily have the same feel. Now, there's a definite empathy for other countries, and a feeling that we will have to really get our act battened down, and then we'll be able to come out and help other countries. I know that various Australian diaspora, I think is the word. This is Aussies who are actually in other countries are going into the hospitals and helping out like that. But I'm just trying to try and give this idea of the background viewpoint. So there's I suppose the biggest existential threat to Australia was the Japanese invading and threat invasion, and so it was the threat physically wasn't there with the Americans and the supply lines. They weren't able to invade. The most they could get is possibly around Port Moresby, but there's no way that they would have the fuel or anything. Anyone who looked at it wouldn't go yet. Australia had gone through religiously and sort of felt what we call a real pants down moment, and so we relocated a lot of our industries out of Sydney back into central into remote Australia. So it would take a lot. But it meant that the industries couldn't really work together in an armaments way, because you'd have 100 kilometres between supply stations. So if you produced a part, you'd then have to put it on a truck, and it wasn't a bit like Europe. These supply companies turned out to be evolved into be the rural industries. So we would, in remote Australia, we had a refrigeration factory which used to produce something similar to alternators for cars and stuff like that, and we had mock cities which were in actual fact producing fuel oil, because Australia was going to be cut off. So we had this coal which could be liquefied called chert, and we had these little villages that from the air looked like rural communities, but in reality were these, and they're really remote and really hard to get to. And this is for the Japanese coming. Even up in Glenbrook, we had a chemical warfare mustard gas supply, and all the bridges were going to be blown up. One of the things that when we pulled out of Malaysia, the Japanese landed wearing Thailand uniform and took over Thailand, and then Thailand sided with Japan. So Japan had an ally in World War II, which was Thailand, and so from that area they went down. And one of the things is that the bridges, they wouldn't blow up properly, and so this sort of really affected us. And so we said, you know, we're going to have to blow everything up. And so they spent a lot of time working out to make sure that when the Japanese came deep, you know, 100 kilometres in, fighting through Sydney, that we'd be able to blow out the main bridges. And then we had secretly stored all hospital supplies. So in terms of that, ahead of times, we had built hospitals knowing that we're going to have this huge toll from the Japanese coming in. That, again, the knowledge that you're going to have to deal with casualties came from World War One, when the British said, "Oh, we'll land you as an invasion force in Turkey." So an Australian amphibious, you wouldn't call it amphibious, people on little wooden boats rowed into machine guns, the Turkish machine guns, and we had huge casualties, and they had nowhere to put all the casualties. And so these ships, which used to have horses and shit in them, like quite literally horses and whatever it is, war supplies, would then fill up. Civilian ships would fill up with Australian casualties. And so there was a sort of a feeling from that. It came from World War II, planning of dealing with the casualties going up. And it was... at the start of World War II, when the Japanese burst into Papua New Guinea, which is which used to be a German colony in the Pacific. The Germans had a little part, so it was Dutch, and the Germans had the other island, a bit of an island above, and we were now little known that the Japanese had done more. The Germans had done more bombing on London, central London, but they also bombed the ports, Plymouth, Southampton, and all that type of stuff. So Darwin got absolutely, completely bombed shitless by the Japanese, and we were sending garrisons, so essentially anyone who could walk was given a bit of a gun and packed on some ships, and they were sent up there to protect, to garrison Darwin. And by the legislation we had, that, you know, emergency troops couldn't be deployed overseas, but they went up with three or four ships from Sydney and Melbourne. And the hospital ship was torpedoed, and this understanding of looking after casualties up there. Now, just to say this was, and so these reserve, really second-rate soldiers were the first soldiers who were put in Papua New Guinea, and they had to actually confront the Japanese. And they were scared shitless, and they ran, and they did sort of, the regulars stopped it, but our reserve forces weren't necessarily, they were very innovative, and they fought very hard, but they weren't very good. And then we had pulled out of the Western Desert, and when we pulled out, Tobruk, the British had a big pullback when... Well, it's a bit more complex than that, but our soldiers were then coming. The first AIF, Australian Infantry Force, but they were put a week or so in Ceylon because Churchill had confused the Australians and wanted them to garrison Ceylon. Now. What the heck? You know, that's the idea that you'd lose Burma, the Japanese would take all of India, and then I don't know. It was something totally insane. Of course, the Indian troops. I don't know. I won't say anything about them. But it took a while for the regular soldiers to get up and integrate with the Japanese, but this was a huge threat, and so we had, well, people, oh, speaking to old people around here, they still have their little World War II passes. Yeah, so what's happened in Australia? A lot's happened, but a lot's been built up. So the sort of a lot of the old Australia's been left because it's been such a big country. It's built up. But from then, all the infrastructure in Australia, one of the major things is, I don't know whether they still do it, but back a few years ago, they were doing engineering surveys to make sure they could blow up every tunnel. The Japanese were long gone. I don't know what's going on. And the engineers would have to blow things up. So I think for a small, who knows what's the modern warfare. Now, there's that. And then the Australians have been pulled out to be in the UN forces in Rwanda and things in or in Vietnam. Vietnam is one example. I think there were something 50,000, 30,000 Australians, and 50 Australians got killed in Vietnam. So killed in bang bang against the, you know, killed in the fighting in Vietnam. There was 550 who died all up from industrial accidents and car accidents and you it's only when you read about the history there that we wouldn't nowadays allow the way the cargo was held. There's no airbags, so all things like those. I think there wasn't even safety belts. You know, you've got all these sorts of things. So and the sort of a lot of the equipment wasn't computer controlled, and so they would go, and there was things of, you know, and they were doing a lot of heavy engineering with ropes, and these were inexperienced people. I do know of one. I do know of several. In my life, I've heard of several times where a high rope has a cable has snapped and whipped around, and, you know, flailed all these people, all these Vietnam people. I think, and there was also the people of dying of diseases and stuff like that in Vietnam. But again, from that, there'd be a health aspect of it going forward. And I know the soldiers who were in Rwanda are the ones in the running the at the COVID-19 at the moment going across. So you've got all those things, and this story of disasters. So look, it's built. The Australian thing is built on this long history of stuff ups. Like the biggest stuff up was sent our maps of the Great Barrier Reef. This is, if you look at Australia, you see Queensland's a big sort of finger pointing up. On the side of that finger, about the length of Italy, is a series of absolutely razor sharp, impassable reefs. If you didn't have the maps, if they were unmapped, that'd be a fantastic barrier. However, we sent the maps off to Japan to be printed, and therefore we actually gave all our maps to Japan to be printed. And there was a whole series of security breaches like this, in terms of we had the Japanese were saying they're going to invest in Australia and buy all your iron ore. The Americans had said don't sell them iron. This is refined, slightly refined iron. So the interesting thing is that we were selling Japanese where this iron, where you it like nowadays with the big shipping you wouldn't do it this way, but back then you can sort of reduce the quantity of iron ore you send to someone by pre-cooking it, getting most of the oxygen off and making these sorts of like lumps of, it's called pig iron, lumps of rust, and so it's low quality. Oh, I don't know, you wouldn't bother doing it, you wouldn't have pig iron, and the thing is that it allows you to get the iron ore to make steel with a whole lot less shipping. That was the major aspect. You didn't have to ship the coal. So Japan was being strangled by the United States. Now, there's sort of similar. Japan was a bit like Iran in terms that they were being pushed. They had and like the Japanese expansion into down south was to get Vietnam, Malaysia, and Indonesia was to get hold of the rubber plantations, because America had cut off its supply to rubber, and so it only had so much supply, only had so much fuel, only had just so much rubber, and so it had to actually take the oil fields. It was either succumb to America or do this mad expansion. Now the mad expansion, there was sort of like the madness with the power, that there was a necessity to get through. And just reading the diaries of these people, some of the Japanese were just on top. So you have these structures, and sort of a lot of the history is here, and a lot of the institutions are not. There's not this. A government sort of enterprising person. It was an enterprising government official that built a lot of the early colonial architecture and decided to open up this. And essentially what happened is that we had, in Australia, squatters. These are enterprising individuals who went out and stole land. So squatting means I steal. They were stealing from the government. So the government came in and said, look, what is it? By this complicated legal argument, we want representations from the Aboriginals. No. We own all the land. It is all the land of the king. Therefore, people coming out here would say, well, where can I go? Well, you have to do something for us to get some of the land. It's like this pre-capitalist system. And so squatters didn't do that. They just said, I'm just popping out here and I'm coming back. Oh, look, I might have this farm, I might have this area. And so you had this squatter area. Then these squatters would have a lot of money and become very powerful, go into politics. And so you had to have this sleight of hand where you would take them in but rewrite history so it was officially. So there's a lot of government paste over of enterprising individuals. So look, there's a lot going like that. There being said, a lot of Australian military thing was sort of trusting and needless. There were places where we decided that we would Australia would knock out this Japanese. Like it's at the very, so the Japanese were going to make a last heroic stand in Papua New Guinea, at Corona and stuff like that. And so rather than just saying, well, you're irrelevant, you're going to move on, Australians said, oh no, we're going to get wipe them out. And we did wipe them out at a huge cost. And this also at Rao, there's Raoul, a place in there. The Japanese did a few war crimes. I'm sure everyone did. Well, I think everyone did, obviously. But these Australian people got executed, absolutely pissed us off. And so we decided, the Americans said, oh, look, we need you to garrison our islands as we move island hop across to relieve troops. So we took over Rau, and there's Japanese in the hill. They said, look, the Japanese in the hill, they're not causing much problem. We can sort of hold 1,000 of them off with 10 soldiers, and they're just going to starve themselves to death. And we said, no, and we massive build up, massive losses. So we can do things wrong. Now, that sort of means that there was this public service leftover from World War II, Vietnam, advising, stuff like that. And also in the nation's capital, which is basically a converted sheep station. So Canberra is a large sheep station, like nothing there. So the capital was built, and they built the university there. And in the university, they've built the blokes who were involved in penicillin, the tropical diseases. Oh yeah, I should also say that as Australia has a major problem with diseases anyway. So this is biosecurity. So that would make a bit more sense to people. So we've got malaria, big problems with malaria, dengue fever, a whole lot of tropical diseases. With sending anyone up to the north, and the issue with these tropical diseases and these people is that there's the local university, and the you've got public services. A lot of public services gone from this local university, and then these public servants go out with inevitable, because one public servant will be one student as they're going through. It didn't happen for me like this, obviously. I went through ANU as well, but it would tend to happen that you would socially mix with these tropical disease people, and they would, and it depends if you that sort of up that top part of the campus, there was the this E for population studies, I've forgotten what that's called. There's a group there, but there's the John Curtin School, and in general, public servants. It's all like it's infectious disease, the understanding. So there were people there, they had a brilliant, it's gone now, sandwich shop at the bottom of the John Curtin School, the cheapest sandwiches. So everyone would go and have those sandwiches. There you'd meet people, and the various people would go out for drinks with people from the infectious disease people, and they'd give you an explanation of influenza, and there was a lot of practice there. Now, so the actual, so your public service, they hadn't completely, well, the public service is still professional, whereas in Britain, they've had cost cutting, and they've really pared down their treasury. Her Majesty's Mint, I think it is called, something like that. Her Majesty's Treasury, or some sort of keeper of the realm of the crown jewels, something like that, but not quite. But it's got that sort of an ancient name, whereas we call it the Treasury, you've got the U.S. Treasury. And in the United States, you do have this the professionals, and the professional can speak to you. But however, there seems to be some other politics, and it's certainly scary, because you speak to politicians and they are in their own world, and they're not necessarily the brightest people. So they try to understand, or they say they understand, but they haven't. Or there's ones which are frighteningly... they wouldn't be called corrupt overseas in that, in terms of that they're not getting, or some of them are getting money under the table, but they're not genuine. I.e., you can't speak to them. You can't say, "Oh, look, this is the situation. I don't have the solution, but this is the problem coming." If you want to do that, if you've got a genuine problem, it's actually best to write to the Civil Service Department, a letter to the minister. There is a way of writing in the sequence. In the sequence there, because by law, every letter has to be answered. So every written letter, so not every email, not every phone call, but every written letter has to, no matter how trivial, how bad it is, has to be processed by this department. So to go through. So Australia also had a dry run for this with the GFC. So we had this massive nest egg, and the GFC came, and then the economists, who were professional economists, were able to advise the government, and they said, "Well, you have to spend big and quick to break the GFC." And so everyone in Australia, every family, got $10,000-$15,000, and there were people, and there were baby bonuses and things like that. So if you had a child, you would get $5,000, or for the GFC, everyone got $14,000, and all the schools, everything, the government spending just went through the roof. There were schools, road built, and then the GFC just didn't happen in Australia. We continued to grow forward. I don't think we'll grow forward on this. So there was this template of, oh, shit happens. If shit happens, trust the government. So we learnt from the GFC, whereas I suppose other countries haven't learnt from this. So when this happened, I do know that people will say they didn't try to convince the government immediately. They said, "Oh, look, yeah, interesting. You should ask that. We'll just wait for a while. We're going to check what the modelling said," and so we've got these disease modelers. Now, to give an idea of the whole of Australia operates on a lot of biosecurity. So if an insect or a farm disease comes in, they lock down the farms, or they won't allow imports of various things. So it's sort of very, biosecurity is part of the fundamental culture around here. So there's various restrictions, like you're not allowed to take grapes, for instance. Like, it would be the crime of the century to actually... There's whole grape-growing regions in Australia, which we don't have the diseases from other countries of the grapes. And there's signs, "Do not take grapes," or "You're not across state boundaries, you're not allowed to take fruit." So there's, there's these food things, and this instruction from this. These are other things of funguses, there's this sort of understanding of non-compliance, and there's this, I suppose there was this general feeling that you'd come up and there would be this non-compliance problem. And we had the in Australia for the COVID, we had the backpackers and the people dancing, not dance, well, yeah, quite literally, we had two outbreaks, one at a wedding and one at a place called Boogie Wonderland. And we're going, so when you read about that, you said, I cannot believe a place exists called Boogie Wonderland. What is this? And so this is a... it would just bore me. I shouldn't say it should bore me shitless. It's all these young people dancing around with cocktails and this music, and everyone, you know, grieving and smiling. This completely, for me, unintellectual place. And this person with an afro and sort of the symbol of Boogie Wonderland. So there was a big outbreak there. Hunting down. So, I think there's 6,300 cases, and but there's been 3,000. It's a little over 3,000 cases in Australia, and of the active cases, more than 1,500, something like 1,800, traced to overseas, and then there's something like 100, 200 cases which have sprung up, and we don't know. And there was to come across, but the general feeling was, I could say, that the our politicians wouldn't get it and wouldn't do the lockdown law. I think there was examples of, like, you read and you, like, people had locked down a lot, locked earlier. Like, there's this, an example of a politician who's been fined for living in the wrong house. He had a house in Sydney and a house on the coast, not near his electorate, but, you know, a holiday house. And he, at the start of the outbreak, moved and set up in his holiday house. And then they introduced the restrictions, and they said, you have to be in your place of residence. To give you an idea, and so he's had to resign, and there's sort of like the reason is that it would be unthinkable of someone mounting a court action complaining against him. And then there's the there's a big ship. So for that, so we've got 6,300 now of cases, and something like 700 cases, or even 1,000 cases, something like above 10%, less than a third of the cases come from a single cruise ship. The cruise ship captain answered these questions, or someone answered these questions, and this is the Ruby Princess. This is the ship of the Diamond Princess, and they said, "Do you have COVID-19? Do you have blah blah blah?" No. They gave answers, and then these people, sort of not knowing the context of it, said, yes, come out, and they just disgorged these people into Sydney. And but what they've done is they've impounded the ship and sent police on board and taken the ship's black box out of it and their computers, to track down eventually who said what. And I don't know whether you could say attempted, that they said they're looking at laying homicide charges across there, which is probably a bit much. But if you are infected and cough or break laws or something like that, there's the footage of people or story of someone coughing on deliberately on the staff there. Now, so this is down. There was at one stage they were talking about getting the ventilators from vets, and if we're going to be short of ventilators, so this may all go, and we're going to have the a huge upswing. Not be able to have the number of beds and stuff available ahead of time, and of course we are trying to take notes from Germany. But getting back to the entire thing is that your entire quality control for a ventilator. The idea that you could build a ventilator. It's not equipping Australian industry to build ventilators. They've got to build it up up to international medical standards. So there's no way, that you can get a animal ventilator and actually qualify across. And of course, if an animal gets lung damaged, it's okay to get across. And if you don't have the pressure set on sticking air pump from the servo down, you just switch it on and just blow their lungs away. So it's a very, very tricky thing doing that. And it's also incubating is extremely hard. I understand it's extremely hard because you've got to get a large tube down a inflamed and very sensitive throat, and it's something which takes a little bit of training to do. So the general message is so the worry, I suppose, here is that there is this culture of biosecurity here, because it's a lot of the crops and stuff like that don't have the overseas diseases, so there's this culture. There's been a horse disease, horse flu. We impounded horses for a while and wouldn't let people onto properties. I'm just trying to think. There's been a few sort of biosecurity stuff like that. Now, what happens is that there's this feeling that, or this thing that people, not rednecks, there's this sort of erosion of faith in your fellow people. So I know these British people came up to us and said, oh, these Australians, they said that we had to wash all our bikes, steam clean all our bikes and steam off all our shovels and everything like that. And you know what? We just said we did, but we didn't do it. And here I'm using it, and you go, oh my God. And of course you can't tell them no. And various people telling you so what's happened is it's sort of like a second disease, this misinformation disease. And it comes along about people, oh, I'm not going to do it. So what's happened is, I think there's sufficient general community compliance that the people who were saying, oh no, it's not going to happen to me, there's still people, sort of excessive reaction people who are out there, but we've got a sufficient, there's that sufficient percentage there which are sort of like thin reeds in the wind that'll blow with the whatever the whiff is, and we'll take nonchalant sort of. They'll be, if someone says, "Look, I'm going to put a basically, I'm going to blow up all these heritage buildings to put a car park," they'll say, "Oh, I like that. Oh, I like," and you just can't stop them. However, what's happened is that there's these, it's people are like that anyway, but there are people on the fringes who will take an opinion, will listen to the opinion around them, and so I think the opinion around them has quietly gone through it. Now, one of the things that I should say, and this is sort of a security stuff, is one of the best. There's the WHO data site, which I've forgotten to once, I can't get back on again. It's got a general beautiful chart showing the number of deaths versus the number of infections of the different countries going out, which is good to see. Unfortunately, it's really a bit disappointing in that China's not revealing its data, so it's got this impossibly good statistically. The data says you're not telling us the truth, unfortunately. But the WHO data is there. There's a problem with over-animating data, making it a bit too hard to read. But there's a website called Worldometer. Worldometer Coronavirus. Can I give you a few bits of advice to go onto it? Is firstly, before you open it, go into your Chrome and thing, and for it, it's impossible. It's Worldometer is, it's sort of really a bit unfortunate in a sense that they're obviously making money out of the coronavirus, which I'll just put an aside from it. So Worldometer is by far the easiest set of data. Unfortunately, if you open up Worldometer, you open up the file, it will put trackers and cookies and stuff like that. You can stop some of the cookies in Chrome. You can't disable all cookies in Chrome, because if you blanket under, it won't open your Gmail account. If you don't operate Gmail, you don't operate a Google thing, it's perfectly okay. So it's got there. But then it also downloads thousands of trackers, no matter how much you set up against it. So you have to have something called CC Cleaner, which is free. So you install that, and after you open up Worldometer once or twice, you'll notice that your computer is going extremely slow, your browser is going slower, because your tracker is now telling so many different companies where what you're looking at. So what you have to do is run CC Cleaner to remove trackers, and of course there's something a bit unusual with that. So after you've done that, you have to eventually, there's a vast premium, I don't know, I'm not, I can say whether you pay for it or not, but then you have to do that, and then again after Worldometer, I don't know why it is, obviously do a boot time virus scan to get across. It's just really achingly slow to do it. It'd be nice. I wonder whether you could open Worldometer if you do have a sandbox or a different type of browser. Do it. And I should say about profiteering. I do know from the United States people that a lot of the foodstuffs have gone up there, or the prices of toilet rolls have gone up. In Australia, such sort of thing would be seen as criminal. No, not criminal in terms of civil law, but sort of morally criminal, and you'd lose all your customers if you did that. And so, with the toilet rolls, what the supermarkets did is that they had time for the pensioner hour, which is the first hour of trading from 7 to 8 o'clock in the morning. So only pensioners, people with disabilities, can go in that hour, and no one else can go. So, and now they're going to bring in other restrictions as well. So there's certain hours, restrictions, and I think most people are getting their stuff home delivered now. But what they did is they just had piles of toilet paper and just gave them. Here it is. Here you can have it. Free. I do know people working on this stock in terms of there's a bit of the a ripple whiplash effect. So Australia's 96% food independent. So 96% of all food in Australia is manufactured in Australia, because it's a huge food bowl, Australia. In order to, I should say about how some of the inside government, like the government's been convinced to spend a huge amount of money and then hold some in reserve for emergency things. So the emergency thing is that all our food supporters, once the international flights didn't come in, so we come with shipping of goods into Australia. So we've got a huge amount of goods coming into Australia on aircraft, and of course the aircraft hulls, the insides of the aircraft are empty, because in general that's what it is. And so in general we've been exporting a lot of perishable food, lobsters, fish, all that type of stuff to other countries, but just by filling the inside of the Qantas jets with perishables. I hope it's not apples and carrots. That would embarrass me. I hope it's you know, high value stuff. But at any rate, so the government has just said, okay, well, we will pay for cargo planes to keep this afloat, to come across here. A similar thing is that everyone's pulling themselves out of childcare, they're losing their jobs, and then they're saying, oh, okay, well, there's free childcare. So that's the end. No system. And I do know that the thing is that they said, oh, we'll double the unemployment benefit and extend it out. And then they said, well, now that you've doubled the unemployment benefit and you're still charging students will disenroll from university. Even with it, they hadn't done the modeling for it. They all had to do is say, well, now that you've done this will create this loophole. Okay, well, we will increase the student payment. And so it's just like, I suppose there's no modelling, but it was just the logic in terms of that. And so the aim of all of this is to stop people panicking or stuff like that. When people can't pay their rent, they'll be kicked out in the street. Oh, that would be a public health emergency. No, you can't evict anybody for 6 months. So the logic has just been, oh, how do you reduce the disease? Okay, well, therefore, and of course, we're going to pay for this for years and years to come. So I don't know how China will go, and I don't know. Major thing is that the major investment, obviously, is not going to be on people who can. People are going to obviously have stockpiles of things, but I think the major investment is people will want to. This person who can sell a end-to-end drop-down factory So things will have changed. So the big epidemics in the feudal, like the Black Death, have said the end of feudalism and stuff like that. And the end of feudalism meant that there was a lot of cash around from all these dead families that went to build the great Gothic cathedrals. So if you look at the end of this, I think what will happen is that people will say, well, look, they'll obviously accelerate the DNA testing development, vaccine development, probably be a bit more aggressive there. The issue is, obviously, there'll be people, terrorists, looking at this saying, what have we been wasting our time on? We'll just drop these, or threaten terror weapons. This will be the new nuclear weapon. But obviously, countries are going to do is saying, oh, well, what we need to do is to have extremely flexible, and China's got towards it. This is not one country. Most countries will want to be able to have an industry. Now, essentially, the reason China can produce it is that they have got links with their machine manufacturing, and so they can order people to make machines, to make ventilators, and the technology to go across. So what people will want to do is be able to order a ventilator making factory or something like that, or order all the capacity quickly. And if you are in a remote place, people can actually, you can print out the precision parts for it, especially if you and the technology. So one of the things one has to understand is that the ventilator technology will change, I can well imagine, it's pointless stockpiling it because the technology will advance. One of the things I could imagine is a sort of a peristaltic membrane on the outside, such that it you just put it in and it actually pulls itself in. It actually moves itself in. Pressure sensors, gas sensors, in there. Like the sensors are going to come down, and the intelligence system, and your Wi-Fi and all that type of stuff, and backup systems, and you can imagine battery powered for a while, sort of Elon Musk style stuff, that you have a ventilator and it can basically run without battery, or you also have oxygen generators. So oxygen generators operate with zeolite. I've forgotten the name of the actual. There's a clay in which the actual clay is a nanostructure material, but the nanostructure has nano holes. It can't crash. It's got huge surface area, and one of the things is that as you put a pressure fluctuation on this clay, the first gas which is released is oxygen. No, this first gas released is nitrogen. So you put put it under pressure, then you bleed off most of the nitrogen, and then afterwards you can bleed off the oxygen, so you can separate it. So you can imagine a portable ventilator, smart ventilator coming up, and the ability to it's not to stockpile it, but to have a factory which can on a switch produce that or anything. So we'll be going into smart manufacturer. The sort of the other thing which I can sort of see is that the masks. So unfortunately, I am your I've spoken to an hour and 5 minutes on this. I couldn't believe this. You've got your masks, and your masks essentially have to absorb a certain. There's sort of psychological value of it, but it's got to. It'd be interesting to actually put your mask on and have some sort of way of having some sort of polymer rubbery thing, so it would stick. It would not rely. It's, you can imagine, not a glue, but some sort of, you know, like the stuff on the electrodes they put on you, that sticky stuff, to form a proper seal. I know it might be uncomfortable, maybe yuck, but then you also have a system. I wouldn't mind a system where you've got a bit of a gap between your first and your outer, and something to do, I suppose, something to do with something to gather moisture. But you've got something on the outside which one of the important things is one of the things I think which would be very interesting to do is to have some sort of electric field in your mask, either to dry heat. I sort of have this feeling of electric field and virus particles and stuff like that. The interesting thing is that obviously some sort of soapy film on the outside. If soap kills it, why not have some sort of soap involved in it? But the idea is that your electrostatic, your ionized pick up your corona discharges, remove. You know, you obviously can't have corona discharge around your mouth, but if the distance is sufficiently small, sort of like a silicon holes with a charge and tubes through it. I don't know how that would necessarily go. So you've got a water droplet. Your water droplet then has to go through a tube with a transverse field that it would actually, and a something which is a highly wetting surface. I was trying to think. There's structures on leaves which operate that way to get it down. But the overall thing is that we haven't. I don't know why the memory of. Oh no, I should also say that the memory of the 1918 virus outbreak has gone. However, there are these little towns in remote Australia. So between Canberra and Sydney, in actual fact, there's these sort of opposite. There's sort of mountains between the two places and lakes, and this is the main roads, freeways there. But if you go off around the side, you're on these fairly thin roads which go past little townships like Bathurst and stuff like that. And you can go into some of these chapels there. So there's the little town, and there's the little creeks there. And we sort of said, oh, we want to go down there. And like I said, there's just heaps of snakes there. Just don't do it. And all of these towns, there are these places where you think you want to have a picnic, and then you discover there's either heaps of mozzies or something wrong with it. But this, you go into these chapels, and it is absolutely full of memorials to a week when the measles went through. And I think there's another town out in remote South Australia where this sort of thing happened. So it's still in memory. And I think one of the things is that if you have... So there's been economic progress in Australia, but it's been sufficiently large to happen in other... It's sort of been added on. So we haven't had to sort of wipe out our whiteboard of memory to get into it. So I hope that's a generalised view, and I'll get in and do some podcasting about my rehab as I go through... You know, the world's been turned upside down for a couple of years for me now. Thanks a lot for listening. Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.